following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
Congress shall make no law representing an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Thus begins the First Amendment to the United States Constitution and the section that we know today as the Bill of Rights. There's a reason that this provision respecting religious liberty is often called America's first freedom. There's a reason that religious liberty is listed before our freedom of speech, before our freedom of the press, before our freedom of assembly, before our freedom to petition our government for redress. The reason that religious liberty is asserted first in the Bill of Rights is because if the state can come between you and God, then nothing else is safe. And yet, religious liberty is perhaps the least understood and least appreciated of our freedoms in America. And that's even true regarding a lot of people of faith. Here's the thing that concerns me. As American society trends to becoming less religious and more secularized, then we are in increasing danger of taking religious liberty for granted. And if we ever lose religious liberty, can our other freedoms be very far behind? This morning's sermon is going to be a little bit different in recognition of Religious Liberty Sunday. Instead of taking a passage of the Bible and kind of working our way through that to try to understand how it applies to us, today, in light of America's 249th birthday, I want to hopefully remind you why religious liberty is so important, what it is, and what we as followers of Jesus need to do to defend it. A good place to start is defining our terms. What exactly is religious liberty? There's a lot of good definitions floating around out there. I just want to share two of them with you this morning. One is from the Baptist Faith and Message 2000, which is the official confessional document of the Southern Baptist Convention. It's not the official document of our church, but our church's articles of faith that are found in our founding documents substantially align with the Baptist Faith and Message 2000. And as part of that definition, there's a line I want to highlight. It says this: a free church in a free state is the Christian ideal. And this implies the right of free and unhindered access to God on the part of all men, and the right to form and propagate opinions in the sphere of religion without interference from the civil power. I also like the definition of religious liberty that our Department of Justice uses, where they define religious liberty as the fundamental right of all Americans to exercise their religion freely without being coerced to join an established church or to satisfy a religious test as a qualification for public office. It also encompasses the right of all Americans to express their religious beliefs, subject to the same narrow limits that apply to all forms of speech. So in a nutshell, religious liberty includes the freedom to believe or not, depending on how your conscience leads you. It involves the freedom to worship according to those beliefs. It involves the freedom to live in accordance with one's beliefs as long as doing so does not interfere with the rights of other people to do the same. And importantly, it includes the freedom to proclaim your beliefs in the public square. So where did this uniquely American conception of religious liberty come from? Down through the ages and in different cultures, there have been little pockets here and there of groups that have promoted religious tolerance, although that is usually the exception rather than the rule. But understand that tolerance is not the same as religious liberty, okay? Tolerance says we may not persecute you because of your beliefs, but we still reserve the right to penalize you for those beliefs and treat you as a second-class citizen. So toleration is fine as far as it goes, but toleration does not always equal liberty. The modern concept of religious liberty as we know it comes from basically two sources. One is the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, with the idea of the recovery of the concept of the priesthood of the believer. And that doctrine says that you and I do not need a human intermediary other than Jesus Christ to allow us to approach God. We don't need the help of a human priest. We don't need the approval of a government official. We can approach God directly through Jesus Christ. And there are a lot of things that come from that. And that helped create what we understand today as this idea of religious liberty. Another source is the Enlightenment of the 18th century with its emphasis on reason and natural law. Although there's a pretty lively debate going on about whether religious liberty was the predicate for the Enlightenment or a result of the Enlightenment. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing, and people a lot smarter than me have been trying to hash that out. So we're going to leave that one alone. We also know, if you know anything about American history, that there were groups who came to this continent in search of religious liberty. But here's the irony. A lot of those colonies, when they got here, they established official churches. In other words, in some of those colonies, it was religious liberty for me, but not necessarily for thee. There were other groups, though, that said, no, religious liberty has to be true liberty for everybody. And among some of those early advocates in the colonies were Baptists. People like Thomas Helwes, who even though he didn't come to America, he was one of the leaders of the original Baptist movement in the 17th century in England. And in 1612, Helwes wrote the first book-length defense of religious liberty. It was entitled A Short Declaration of the Mystery of Iniquity. We also be thankful for men like Roger Williams. In 1637, Williams founded the colony of Rhode Island as a haven for religious dissenters. A few months later, in 1638, he established what is considered the very first Baptist church in the New World, the first Baptist church of Providence, Rhode Island. In 1644, Williams wrote a book that became very pivotal. It was entitled The Bloody Tenet of Persecution, in which he called for religious liberty for all people. We also think back to men like Isaac Bacchus. Bacchus was a Baptist pastor in Massachusetts during the days of the American Revolution. And in 1773, he wrote a pamphlet entitled An Appeal to the Public for Religious Liberty Against the Oppression of the Present Day. It rocked a lot of boats when he published it. And then there was his friend, John Leland. Leland was a Baptist evangelist, friend of Bacchus, who was active in the state of Virginia. Leland was also a friend of a couple of guys you might have heard of, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. Maybe those names ring a bell. Leland wrote a widely distributed tract called The Rights of Conscience Inalienable, in which he argued that unless the government can answer for individuals on Judgment Day, it had better stay out of our relationship with God. Leland, most importantly, lobbied Madison and Jefferson to include religious liberty protections in this document they were writing called the Constitution. And those freedoms were patterned after a measure that had already been passed in Virginia called the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. So in other words, if you love the First Amendment, think a Baptist, because we were right there in the middle of it. Why are Baptists so concerned about religious liberty? Well, one reason is past experience as a persecuted minority. You may find this hard to believe, with Southern Baptists being the largest Protestant denomination in the country right now, but there was a time when we were on the outside looking in. The early Baptists were nearly always a minority and nearly always at odds with the official state church. For example, in 1770, 10 Baptist preachers were imprisoned in the county jail in Culpeper, Virginia. Their crime? Preaching without the approval of what is now the Episcopal Church, which then was the official state church of the colony of Virginia. Yeah, they didn't have a piece of paper from the Episcopal bishop saying you had the right to preach the gospel. They got thrown in jail for violating that order. When I lived in Louisiana back in the 90s, there were still stories from within living memory, in other words, from within three generations, of Baptist preachers getting physically assaulted and run out of towns in some of the more rural Catholic villages in South Louisiana. Think of it this way. Maybe this will help you get your head around it. It's easy to be a Volunteer fan in Knoxville. Amen? Somebody say, go Vols. Okay. Imagine being a Volunteer fan in Tuscaloosa. All right. Now, that's possible, but imagine this. Let's play a little thought experiment here. Imagine you're a Vols fan, you're living in Tuscaloosa, and Tuscaloosa passes a law requiring everybody who lived there to cheer for the Crimson Tide. Imagine, by law, not being allowed to meet with other UT volunteer fans to watch a game. Imagine being fined for wearing your big orange t-shirt out in public. Imagine being arrested for singing Rocky Top. Imagine not being able to hold a job or buy a house or drive a car unless you could vouch that you pulled for the University of Alabama. Now, under such a scenario, what would your options be? Well, you could convert and become a Bama fan. You could outwardly yell Roll Tide while secretly humming Rocky Top. You could cheer for the Vols openly and run the risk of being persecuted or prosecuted. Or you could move out of town. Honestly, do any of those seem fair to you? Just because you pull for a different team. Because Baptists have faced persecution like that for religious reasons, then we want to protect everybody's freedom of conscience. But not only is it our past experience as a persecuted minority, it's also Baptist principles that are derived from Scripture. One thing we believe in as Baptists is that all people are created in the image of God. Genesis 1:27 tells us, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And we believe as Baptists that part of being created in God's image is to possess both a basic human dignity that ought to be respected and a capacity to seek after God. Another principle that we hold dear is that every person is accountable to God uniquely and personally. In Luke 12, verses 4 and 5, Jesus said this, "My friends, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body, but after that have nothing more they can do. But I warn you whom to fear. Fear the one who, after he has killed someone, has the power to throw that person into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." In other words, there's only one ultimate judge that we need to worry about, and we need to be concerned that we're respecting and honoring him, regardless of what the state says. As James, Jesus' own brother, puts it in James 4:12, there's only one lawgiver and judge, the one who's able to save and to destroy. But who are you judging your neighbor? In Romans 14, Paul talks about this scenario that was going on in the church of Rome. You had people who'd grown up Jewish. You had people who'd grown up pagan. They'd come to believe in Jesus. And now they were trying to build a church together and get along. But some of the people were saying, you know what? If you want to be a good Christian, first you got to become a good Jew. You got to follow all the things that go along with Jewish culture. You got to keep a kosher diet. You got to observe the Sabbath on Saturday instead of on Sunday, as most Christians do, in honor of the resurrection. And so Paul says, listen, you're going to tear your church apart over stuff like that. And then he says this in Romans 14, verses 3 and 5. He says, the one who eats is not to regard with contempt the one who does not eat. And the one who does not eat is not to judge the one who eats, for God has accepted him. Who are you to judge the servant of another? To his own master he stands or falls, and he will stand, for the Lord is able to make him stand. One person values one day over another, another values every day the same. Each person must be fully convinced in his own mind. You and I stand before God on our own. We have to answer to him. We are accountable to God uniquely and personally. And along with that is the idea that true faith cannot be coerced. Hebrews 11:6 says, without faith, it is impossible to please him. The one who comes to God must believe that he exists and that he proves to be the one who rewards those who seek him. Faith, trust, is the basis for everything in our relationship with God. And that faith has to be genuine. It has to be real. Acts 4 verses 19 and 20, Peter and John get arrested for preaching the gospel. They get drugged before the authorities. And they answered and said to them, whether it's right in the sight of God to listen to you rather than God, make your own judgment. We cannot stop speaking by what we've seen and heard. In other words, hey, you guys may tell us we can't preach. God sent us out to preach. Who do you think we ought to listen to, huh? Same situation comes up in Acts chapter 5. Peter's, again, drugged before the authorities. And he said, Peter and the apostles answered, we must obey God rather than men. In Galatians 1:10, Paul says this, am I now seeking the favor of people or of God? Or am I striving to please people? If I were trying to please people, I would not be a bondservant of Christ. We have to have a genuine conviction in our hearts on God's truth. We have to listen to His voice, not the voice of others. We have to trust Him, no one else. Experience has shown that a coerced faith is either a false faith or a shallow faith. Real faith has to be genuine and non-coerced. And along with that idea goes this: the state has no business coming between the individual conscience and God. Matthew 22:21, Jesus said, "Pay to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." The church and the state both have separate God-ordained spheres of influence. And liberty is maximized when the church does not intrude on the state sphere and the state does not intrude upon the church sphere. And that doesn't mean the church can't speak prophetically into the state sphere to say, "Hey, this is what God says, you're crossing a line." It doesn't mean the state doesn't have an interest in sometimes intruding into the church sphere, like fire codes, okay? To say, "Hey, if you're going to meet together in a building, at least take some safety precautions." But the basic idea is the church has its lane, the state has its lane, don't get in each other's lanes. This is the Baptist formulation of a free church in a free state. Often you hear this phrase tossed around, the wall of separation of church and state. And a lot of times it's used as a club to beat religious people over the head. Amen? That phrase does not appear in the Bible, although the principle is suggested in Jesus' words here in Matthew. I'll give you another news flash to surprise a lot of people. That phrase also does not appear in the U.S. Constitution. You know where it comes from? It comes from a letter Thomas Jefferson wrote to some Baptist friends in Danbury, Connecticut in 1802. You can go online to look that letter up and read it for yourself. And from the letter, it's clear that Jefferson's wall was not intended to protect the state from the church, which is how a lot of people try to interpret it. Rather, Jefferson was trying to protect the church from the state. To say to the state, "Caesar, stay in your lane and leave us alone." In Revelation 13, we have this prediction of a future world leader who will attempt to direct worship away from God and towards himself. He will seek to assume the place that rightfully belongs only to God. And he will be labeled as the beast. Whether you're looking at the Old Testament, the New Testament, or human history, they're all clear. Whenever a human government attempts to usurp the place of God, the results become beastly and bloody. We've gotten a little taste of what that looks like. First of all, we can notice it from history. We saw what happened in the 1930s in Germany when a government tried to assume the place of God and millions of people were brutally killed as a result. We've seen in communist regimes down through the 20th century into the 21st where the state has tried to assume godlike proportions and people are brutalized and killed by the millions. We've gotten a taste of that ourselves in 2020. Now, I'm so thankful I lived in the state of Tennessee during that period, because our governor worked really hard to find that balance between religious freedom and public health. But there were some states where that was not so fortunate, where you had government officials who got a little high on their own supply and decided to use that opportunity to squelch the church and tell churches what they could and couldn't do. Thankfully, it took a while, but courts began to push back and say, "You can't do that." But we've seen all too easily how government officials can deny religious liberty to try to advance their own agendas. Again, I'm thankful I live in Tennessee. Now, what does religious liberty look like? Well, true religious liberty recognizes and respects inherent human freedom. The freedom to believe as your conscience dictates, which includes the freedom to be wrong. It also includes the freedom to associate with others who share your beliefs. It includes the freedom to worship as your beliefs prescribe. And it involves, and this is where some people in our day fall short, it involves the freedom for your beliefs to shape your actions in the public sphere, as long as your expression of liberty does not interfere with the liberty of others. So we have some people that want to say, they want to redefine religious liberty to mean freedom of worship. And what they mean by that is, hey, whatever you do in your own house, whatever you do in the four walls of your church, go do it. But once you step outside, you got to toe the line with the rest of us. I don't want to hear about your God when you're out in the public sphere. Hey, that's not what the First Amendment is all about. The First Amendment is about protecting your right, not just to worship God, but to pattern your life after God's teachings. And as long as you're not interfering with somebody else's right to do the same, the government has no business trying to put limits on yours. In the United States, our courts have defined limited circumstances in which the state may legitimately inhibit religious liberty. The government, according to the courts, may limit religious liberty for a compelling state interest, such as preserving the liberty of others or protecting public safety. Imagine, what if you had a person who claimed, well, my religion teaches me that whenever I encounter somebody with red hair, I need to kill them on the spot. The government says, no, we're not going to do that. And as a person who used to have red hair, I am very thankful for that. See, in that case, the state has a compelling interest to protect innocent people with red hair. The courts have also said that when the state must intervene, it has to do so with the least restrictive means available. And that's a lot of what works out through our court system to try to hash out what those least restrictive means are. Is religious liberty under threat? Well, that depends on your perspective. In some ways, religious liberty in the United States has never been stronger. In recent years, religious liberty advocates have enjoyed an impressive stream of victories at the U.S. Supreme Court, including most recently the Mahmoud versus Taylor decision just about a little over a week ago, which asserted the rights of parents to opt their kids out of school instruction that challenged their religious beliefs. On the other hand, there are some ominous clouds on the horizon. As fewer Americans identify as religious, there are fewer who appreciate the value of religious liberty. And then there are those who seek to impose a militant secularism on American society, and in doing so, try to drive all religious voices out of the public square. Considering those two challenges, people of faith need to be vigilant. We need to affirmatively work to protect our right to religious liberty, using all the means that are available to us legally in this country. Our forefathers left us a tremendous heritage of religious liberty. And we need to avoid the mistake of Esau. You remember what Esau did in Genesis 25, right? Esau comes in from the field and he says to his brother Jacob, "Man, I am starving. How about a bowl of your famous stew?" And Jacob says, "It's going to cost you." Esau says, "I don't care. I'm dying here, brother. You got to help me out. What do you want?" He says, "Tell you what, trade me your birthright. I'll give you some stew." We got to understand the birthright in that culture was huge. The birthright was what was going to give Esau leadership of the whole clan when his father died. The birthright was going to entitle him to a double share of the inheritance of the property that belonged to that clan when his father died. But Esau had no respect for that. He didn't appreciate that. He didn't want to think about what was going to happen years later. He was hungry right now. "Brother, I'm going to die if you don't give me something to eat. What good to me is the birthright if I starve to death? Give me some soup." So he traded away this priceless inheritance for a bowl of chili. Folks, in a lot of ways, we are in danger of trading away our birthright to religious liberty for a bowl of beans. We trade away our inheritance through neglect, through ignorance. We also trade away our birthright when we cozy up too closely to government in the attempt to advance heavenly goals with earthly power. Let he who has ears to hear, hear. Hey, we don't need to try to accomplish the values of heaven with the power of Caesar. If we neglect our right to religious liberty, we wake up one day to find out we no longer have it. So how can we protect our religious liberty? One, exercise your religious liberty rights. Be aware of them, practice them, jealously guard them. Two, defend religious liberty for everybody. And sometimes that's going to mean speaking up for people that we have profound disagreements with. A few years ago, there was a widely watched court case from New Jersey in which a community up there was accused of unfairly using zoning laws to prevent the construction of a Muslim mosque. Now, a couple of our Southern Baptist entities submitted Friends of the Court briefs in that case, supporting the rights of the Muslims. And man, that created a hornet's nest of controversy among Southern Baptist ranks. Because you had some people saying, "What are you doing giving our cooperative program dollars to support Muslims to spread their religion?" Well, I mean,
In one way, you can look at it that way. Or you could look at it from the perspective that our entities weren't supporting Muslims' right to preach their faith. They were defending our right to preach ours. Because hear me, folks, law is a double-edged sword, okay? And in an increasingly secularized society that does not respect any religion, any law that could restrict Muslims from building a mosque can and will at some point be used to restrict a church from building a property of its own. If you're really concerned about other religious groups actively spreading their message in America, I got a good solution for you, okay? The answer is not to pass a law and ask the government to fight that battle for us. The answer is to vigorously exercise our own religious liberty, get up out of the pews and go out and preach Jesus. Don't ask Caesar to do that for us. That's our job. And I have more faith in the power of the gospel than the power of Caesar. It's not the law that provides salvation. The law never saved anybody. In fact, it's condemned most people. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation for all who believe. So if we're worried about competing ideas floating around out there, let's get out and start sharing the gospel. Let's start telling people about Jesus. And along with that, let's live faithfully for Jesus regardless. Sadly, human history shows us that religious liberty is not guaranteed. However, the power of the gospel has demonstrated or is demonstrated in the fact that it often spreads fastest in societies that actively seek to stamp it out. I don't know how accurate the statistics are. I don't know how you go about counting such things, but there are claims made. There are now more Christians in China than there are members of the Communist Party. There recently was announced there's now over 1 million Bible-believing Christians in Iran. Man, the gospel has this amazing power to infiltrate and penetrate and change people's lives even as the government tries to stamp it out. Let's trust the gospel. But if we're boldly going to proclaim the message of Jesus, we also need to live out the message of Jesus so that other people will see us living out our faith and be drawn to it. We can't proclaim Jesus with our lips while we're denying him with our hands. For our witness to be effective, our walk must match our talk. We have been given an incredible opportunity in this country to walk and talk about Jesus openly. Let's don't throw that away. There's a slavery that can exist even in the midst of the freest country on earth. And all around us, there are people who are enslaved. They're enslaved to their passions. They're enslaved to the pursuit of pleasure or treasure or recognition or other people's opinions. And they live their whole lives in bondage to those things. However, there's also a freedom that can exist even in the most adverse slavery. Others can control your body, but they can't control your soul unless you let them. And when you give your soul to Christ, no one can take that away from you. And even no matter what they do to your body, your soul can be free. As Jesus said, John 8:36, if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. If you want to celebrate some freedom, there's some freedom to celebrate.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.